You're Connected is the official audio podcast of the Miami University Alumni Association, available exclusively to the organization's dues-paying members.
Hi, this is Ray Mock, Executive Director of the Miami University Alumni Association. As a dues-paying member, you have demonstrated a desire to deepen your connection to Miami. Our goal is to keep that connection strong. With Your Connected audio podcasts, we offer a sample of the Miami experience in an easy-to-use format. Check back often for the latest programs. Hear what's being taught in the classroom and learn how alumni play a key role in the life of the university. The first series of Alumni Association podcasts feature speakers from Winter College, Florida and Winter College Out West, held in February 2007. Each year, Winter College offers a dynamic weekend of lectures and lively discussions. Sit back and enjoy these lectures from some of Miami's most accomplished faculty. Best of all, there will be no quizzes.
I am a graduate of Miami. My wife is a graduate of Miami as well. When I decided to go back to graduate school, there was little by way of choice as to where I could go. And my wife agreed that I could take off work, but I had to go to Miami. And I'm glad for it. The department's been great, and it helped me in finding this obscure topic for a dissertation, which fortunately for me has become fairly popular in the last year or so. So what we'll do today is I'll talk about the signing statement in an overview. You'll have a crash course in it, so you'll be better able to educate your friends and family the next time it comes up around the dinner table. So my first is, how did this obscure device become so popular? Much of what we know about the signing statement is its relationship to the Bush administration. And the way in which it's been described is a tool to enable the Bush administration to override the Constitution. And in fact, that's a bit overboard. And so in 2006, this obscure topic, as I noted there, took off after an article appeared in the Boston Globe. And the article in the Boston Globe titled, "The Bush Administration Challenges Hundreds of Laws." And under it, the Bush administration quietly claimed the authority to disobey more than 750 laws. I spoke with the reporter at the time, and he has continued to do research on this particular topic, but its popularity came about as its comparison to a line item veto. In fact, this is the way in which most people have understood it, including members of Congress. Senator Spector last year, when he held hearings on the signing statement, he claimed that the signing statement was used by the administration to cherry pick laws, pick things that it wanted to enforce and other things that it didn't. And after this article appeared, the response, as you can imagine, was calm and measured. The response, whether it was in newspaper articles, whether it was in discussions among law faculty or even members of Congress, probably did more to obscure this device than it did to educate as to what exactly it was. As I said, after the article appeared, there were several different places in which folks responded to it. The Senate June of 2006, held a hearing in which they invited a member of the Justice Department to come and testify. The Justice Department sent, unfortunately for this person, probably the person who didn't know anything about it, to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which infuriated members of the Senate. They saw it as a slap in the face, being sent somebody who couldn't answer some of their basic questions. Last month, the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on it, and they promised to hold more hearings on the signing statement as the year progresses. There also were a number of responses by particular interest groups, the most famous being the American Bar Association. American Bar Association, in a National Press Club talk last summer, announced that it was going to hold findings on the presidential signing statement to introduce to members who met last August in Honolulu, and then the American Bar Association promised that they would have their own statement about the signing statements, which they issued last August. And then a couple of other groups, the American Constitution Society and the Constitution Project. Also, among our editorial boards, left and right across the country, most of them unanimously condemned the ability of the president to challenge, to refuse to enforce or defend provisions of law that the president had signed. So after all of this response, did it have an effect on the administration? It didn't. In fact, very little as to what's going on in the outside political environment has any measured effect on the president's use of the signing statement, including presidents prior to this administration. At the end of 2006, the administration was back in the papers where President Bush had signed a postal appropriations bill. In it, the president clarified a provision, and that provision was taken to mean that the administration could open our mail without a warrant, just willy-nilly, when in fact that's not the clarification that the administration used. And by the end of 2006, that over 750 number that was reported back in April had grown to well over 1,100 challenges to the bill, or to various provisions of law. So the question is, when we get rid of President Bush, do we get rid of the problem? And in fact, we don't. The problem didn't start with him, and the problem isn't going to end with him. And we can even ask the question of whether it's a problem at all. What I want to do then today is to talk about what a signing statement is. There's little understanding precisely what this thing actually is that the president uses. I want to talk about the different uses that the president has for a presidential signing statement. I want to talk about the history of it and whether or not this administration developed it the way it has been used currently. And then finally, to put into context just where President Bush fits among presidents prior as far as his use of the various parts of the signing statement. So what is the bill signing statement? Here's a signing statement to Isaac Newton that was in was one of the editorial cartoons that appeared in papers across the country. He says, "I'm having a problem with parts of this gravity law. See the attached signing statement." The signing statement is nothing more than an appendage the president makes to a law that he has signed. The presidents, as I'll note here in a minute, have done this for over 100 years. When the president signs a bill, and he doesn't do it all the time, and only a small percentage of all bills that a president signs will he use a signing statement. What he does is he'll make this statement. Sometimes it's done very publicly, and the public signing statement is probably what many of you have in mind when you think about a signing statement. More often, though, he does it privately. That is, it's a written signing statement, not done in any sort of public context, but nonetheless comes with the bill after the president has signed it into law. The usage of the signing statement takes one of two forms. The first is that it's a rhetorical device that the president uses for a wide variety of different reasons. The second way in which the president uses it has constitutional implications. And the constitutional implications is what most of us are interested in when we study the signing statement, because here the president is really doing something with a bill he has just signed into law. But first, before I get to that, the rhetorical signing statement. Here, the president is seeking to influence or gain the attention or show the appreciation to a group of individuals that the president wants to have good relationships with. Most of the time, it's to members of Congress. He'll thank members of Congress for the work that they did on a particular provision of a bill. Sometimes he'll scorn members of Congress. Most of it, though, it's done very cordially, particularly when it's bipartisan support. Or the president will single out key interest groups. Interest groups love to see their name in presidential speeches or presidential proclamations. President Clinton, for example, who used the rhetorical signing statement most of all of the recent presidents, would often single out interest groups, thanking them for the work that they did and hoping that they'll join the administration in future efforts. And then the interest groups will then send the signing statement out to all of their members to show that they have the attention of the president. And this is usually what we think of when we think of a bill signing statement. A lot of happy faces behind the president. The president sitting at the desk there. Sometimes it's outside in the Rose Garden. Everybody gets a pen when the president's done signing it. The picture that you see for members of Congress, they'll send back to the local presses or they'll send to key fundraisers, to key contributors. But nonetheless, to show that their work actually meant something, that it not only was just something in the Congress, but also something to affect the laws that we're all obligated to follow. The second one, though, the constitutional signing statements. Of the constitutional signing statements, there are three different reasons why a president will issue a signing statement that seeks to influence a particular provision of a bill or of a law that he's just signed. Two of the three have the intent to influence the legislative history of a bill. When Congress passes legislation, it wraps up in that legislation all of the actions that took place on the floor of the Congress. It'll place committee reports. It'll do everything it possibly can to make sure that if challenged in the courts will understand what the Congress's intent was, particularly on provisions of a bill that may not be clear. And so what the president has done in this instance is to argue that he has significant legislative powers, which he does, that he has every right as members of Congress to place his intent for the law alongside members of Congress, and so that if a bill is challenged, judges, if they're going to use legislative history, should also use the president's understanding of the law. And it's been recent that presidents have done that, as I'll talk about in a minute. Since the late 1980s, presidents have been adding signing statements to the legislative history in an attempt to influence judges. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's really hit or miss. When the president began adding the signing statement to the legislative history of bills, most legal scholars argued that it was designed to influence the courts. And in fact, when the president announced that they were going to begin adding signing statements to the legislative history, they even said that part of the reason we want to do that is to make sure that the president's understanding is alongside of Congress's understanding. But as I have found, and as I argue, that is secondary to the real reason why they added the signing statement to the legislative history. The real reason is to influence the bureaucracy. Going back to the Nixon administration, it was the bureaucracy that stood as a roadblock in front of the president to get the president's plan, his promise to the public, in place. And so, starting with the Nixon administration, presidents tried a number of different types of devices to get control of the bureaucracy. Most of it didn't work. The Reagan administration, however, figured out, in a number of other actions that they used, that they could influence executive branch decision making if they were careful and precise about how they did it. And so the second reason, the president argues that since he is constitutionally obligated to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, it should mean that every time an executive branch agent has to interpret the law, that he or she interprets it the way that the president would want it interpreted or implemented. This the president has control over. The courts, the president doesn't have much control over, but here clearly they do. And we have a lot of evidence that the president has been successful in using the signing statement to put in front of any executive branch agent when he or she is trying to interpret the meaning of law. And then finally, for all of you and your understanding of the signing statement, this is what most of us know about the signing statement today. That is, the president, when he signs a bill into law, somehow or for some reason decides that parts of it he will not either enforce or he won't defend if challenged. Here, the president relies upon the oath he took when he took office. And that oath was to not only defend the office of the presidency, but more importantly, the same oath that all constitutional officers take, that he will preserve, defend, and protect the Constitution. And the president, in this case, argues that if I have a bill, and because Congress gives me bills that are loaded with different programs or loaded with different restrictions, if I have a bill that I have to sign, because it's important that the bill helps the country in some particular way, parts of it I think are unconstitutional. I would violate my oath. I would violate my oath of office if I went ahead and enforced or defended a provision of law that I believe to be unconstitutional. Now, most of us, if we remember our civics courses, remember that 200 plus years ago, the court in Marbury versus Madison decided that it had the right to determine what the law is. Many, in the way it's taught, the textbook part of this, suggests that the courts have the final say, that Congress passes law, the president executes it, and if challenged, it's up to the courts to decide whether it's constitutional or not. Well, there's been a minority view ever since that Marbury decision, which has really been more of a majority view when we talk about the president of the last 25 or 30 years, who will argue that all Marbury versus Madison did was it enabled the courts to have a say as far as the meaning of the Constitution. Not the final say, but just a say. Therefore, as president, I have as much right as Congress, and I have as much right as the courts to determine the constitutionality of law that I'm expected to enforce. And then it's up to the other branches to decide, particularly Congress, whether or not my interpretation prevails. And so here, all the president does is to rely upon his constitutional oath, not to defend or enforce provisions of law that he believes to be unconstitutional. Now the history, from start to finish. Unfortunately, after the Globe piece was published, and for most academics, they see the signing statement as something that has happened only recently, when in fact that's wrong. The signing statement has deep roots in American history, going all the way back at least to the Monroe administration that I've been able to find. Some have suggested that it even stretches back to the Jefferson administration, back to the third president of the United States. That is, when faced with a law that the president finds to be have problems in it, what does he do? President Monroe exercised the kind of power that President Bush has currently exercised when faced with a law that he found to be constitutionally problematic, though on the whole, the law was a benefit to the country. In this case, there was an appropriations bill, and in the appropriations bill, there were restrictions placed upon the president's commander-in-chief powers. When Monroe signed the bill into law, he basically told the Congress that it has no right to tell me how I can handle the military. This dealt with appointment of officers. This is a constitutional right given to the president alone, and the Congress has no business telling me what to do. And in fact, his interpretation prevailed. Congress never responded to his unwillingness to manipulate the military in the way that they wanted to. President Jackson, President Jackson, when faced with an appropriations bill that ordered the federal government involvement in building roads inside the states, told the Congress that it can tell me what kind of roads to build in the territories, but not the states. The Constitution is clear in giving separate powers to the national government and the state government. The two shouldn't mix. And so in President Jackson's signing statement, he told Congress that I will enforce the provision so long as it's constitutional, that is, to build the roads inside the territories of the United States. But where it goes outside of that, I will not enforce it. Congress responded, arguing that this was an ironclad veto, that is, the president has stricken out a provision and not given it a chance to respond, but that's about as far as Congress took it. They were unable to get the president to alter his interpretation of the bill, and it stuck. Then towards the latter part of the 19th century, Tyler in particular, we had a string of presidents who were fairly weak. President Tyler simply made a comment on a bill that he signed into law, the rhetorical variety that I mentioned a minute ago, arguing that perhaps Congress may wish to reconsider in the future putting these kinds of provision into law. Congress was outraged at the president's issuing of the signing statement. John Quincy Adams, who now is a member of the House of Representatives, sent a letter back to the president telling him that if he ever put another signing statement onto the bills that he were signing into law, he would have him charged with defacing public documents. And the 19th century then sort of closed without much fanfare over the signing statement. The 20th century, though, as government grew, the number of instances in which presidents used signing statements grew alongside them, particularly of the rhetorical variety, but also otherwise. In FDR's administration, we have an instance in which the president, in his signing statement, finds something to be unconstitutional, argues that if it's challenged, he will not defend it. And when the law went into effect, it was challenged. FDR sent a notice to Congress telling them that in my signing statement I told you I would not defend this and I'm not going to. Left it up to Congress then to defend it. Congress did and they lost. In the decision United States versus Lovett, the Supreme Court references President Roosevelt's signing statement as guidance towards their interpretation of the provision in which they refused to defend. The story though doesn't really take off until we get to Watergate. And it's Watergate that has really driven the need for presidents to do whatever they possibly can to defend their office, as well as to put in place their agenda when their agenda fails inside Congress. After Watergate, the presidencies of Ford and Carter, we call them the imperiled presidency rather than the imperial presidency. In those two presidencies, public opinion was decidedly against the president. Members of Congress were hostile towards the president, but the president was still expected to lead. And so what we see in Presidents Ford and Carter, the issuing of more constitutionally oriented signing statements, directives to executive branch agencies telling them to implement provisions of law in a way that the president prefers, because the president loses out in Congress. Or, as in the case of President Carter, Congress begins to add more and more restrictions on the power of the president, and President Carter then responds by challenging those restrictions. And had it really not been for President Carter in particular, the Reagan administration probably would not have discovered the signing statement in the manner that they did. Which brings us to the Reagan administration. When we talk about the strategic implications of the signing statement, it begins with the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration was very creative in how it not only defended the office, but also how it protected its agenda. And in the Reagan administration, we see the announcement in 1986 that the signing statement would be added to the legislative history of all bills that the president, or of any bill the president signs into law. They give the reason the Reagan administration does to make sure that judges understand the president's interpretation as well as Congress. And in it, they cite two instances during the Reagan period in which the courts used the signing statement as guidance. The 1983 decision dealt with what we call the legislative veto, an ability for committees in Congress to veto an action by an executive branch agent. This drove presidents crazy, and in 1983, the Supreme Court got it. And in their majority opinion, they referenced presidential signing statements going all the way back to the Wilson administration as never believing that these particular devices were constitutional. In 1986, there's a mixing of legislative and executive power. President Reagan, in his signing statement, argues that the mix is unconstitutional. I will disentangle it and implement it in a way that is constitutional. It gets challenged by a member of Congress who argues that presidents can't do this. In the 1986 decision, in the very first footnote, the majority cites in its opinion, they cite President Reagan's signing statement. So clearly the Reagan administration understood that it does have some influence over judicial decision making. Not a lot, perhaps, but some. And so when judges are looking to sign, to decide meaning of law, they might as well have the president's understanding as well as Congress. The bureaucracy, though, is really where the president's aim, the Reagan administration's aim was at. When I was doing my dissertation work, I had the opportunity to talk with a number of former Reagan appointees, and I asked them, you know, take me through the steps that brought you to adding the signing statement to the legislative history of bills they were signing into law. And they all argued, or they all told me, that the courts in the 1980s made it possible for the president's interpretation to have real meaning inside the executive branch agencies. In this 1984 decision, the court, in deciding this public administration law, found that when bureaucrats were faced with a provision of a law that was unclear, they could do two things. First, they had to find out what the meaning of the bill was as far as Congress understood it. So look through the legislative history and find out what Congress meant by certain provisions of a bill. Where that understanding is absent, and if you know the nature of modern bills, these things are huge. And for the most part, they involve compromises whereby language may be taken out to make sure that the bill survives passage by both the House and the Senate. Where that congressional intent is absent, then, executive branch administrators should use reasonable discretion in implementing the law. And for the Reagan administration, reasonable administrative discretion meant the president's understanding. And it really was this 1984 case that gave the Reagan administration an in. And we know from evidence since the Reagan administration that it had an impact. It did influence in certain ways how the executive branch interpreted provisions of law. They knew the president was standing over their shoulder watching what they did, and they wanted to make sure most of all that they pleased the administration that they were working for. It didn't stop though with the Reagan administration. The Bush 1 administration, the Clinton administration, both of them continued to use the signing statement in all forms in ways that added to what the Reagan administration had done with the signing statement in the 1980s. Up until this Bush administration, the son's Bush administration, his father's was cited as the one that was most concerned with defending the powers of the president. In fact, the first Bush administration would carefully comb through all bills that the president was about to sign and issue objections to anything that might restrict the powers of the presidency. And so Bush 1, he uses the third type of a constitutional signing statement more than President Reagan had, more than any other previous president had. He also uses it in ways that is fairly creative. For example, when a bill would come up for reauthorization, despite the fact that presidents had settled on a particular meaning for certain provisions, that had no bearing as far as the first Bush administration was concerned. And the first Bush administration began interpreting provisions of settled law differently than previous presidents had. This was challenged. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court argued that the president who is in office has every right to decide the meaning of law despite the fact that there may be a settled definition for certain provisions of law going back several presidencies. They also, when they were faced with obstruction inside Congress, used the signing statement to create what I call an alternative legislative history on a particular provision of law. Where the Bush administration lost out on the floor of the Congress, fellow Republicans were busy developing this alternative legislative history so that when President Bush signed the bill into law, he could point to what the minority was doing on the floor of the Senate or the floor of the House as guidance for the executive branch agencies should they be required to interpret the meaning. Clinton administration, I mean, most people thought that the signing statement was something that really only Republican presidents had used, particularly because they faced divided government, the party of the presidency being different from the party that controlled both houses or one house of Congress, when in fact it didn't really matter whether it was divided or unified government. The Clinton administration picks up where the Bush administration left off. Office of Legal Counsel, which is in the Department of Justice, it issues two fairly sweeping defenses, both of the right to use the signing statement, as well as the right for the president to interpret the constitutionality of law. And when the Republicans took over in 1995, the administration behaves in the way that the Reagan and Bush administrations before it had, winning battles inside the executive branch agencies that they lost to the Republicans in Congress, as well as to defend the powers of Congress right to the very end. This case dealing with an appropriations to the Department of Energy would be a case in point. There was after the scandal in the late 1990s involving the release of secrets at our nuclear laboratories, Congress wanted to put a person in the Department of Energy who would be autonomous from the president, that is, free from pressure from the executive branch. And when President Clinton signed the bill into law, he nullified that independence, arguing that the president has the right to direct inferior executive branch officers, and President Clinton went out of office defending that right. Now, by the numbers, to give us a sense then of where this president fits as to those who came before him. The signing statements, by the way, there's nothing secret about them. It may have been secret simply because members of the Congress or reporters or whomever didn't know where to look, but these things are published publicly, and you can find them in a variety of different places if you so choose. The weekly compilation of presidential documents is online, and you can do a search for that term, and it'll give you the weekly compilation. You can look through them and see all the signing statements you want. There are also a variety of individuals who have been creating a database of all signing statements as well to make it easier for the public to get at what these things actually are. There also was confusion as to what we meant, particularly when we had those big numbers of 1,143, what that meant. The administration has argued, this administration has argued, that it has issued fewer signing statements than the presidents before them. And they're right. They have issued fewer signing statements, the actual document called a signing statement, than any president before. That's not what's important here. What's important is the details. And in those few signing statements, the administration gets every bit of its money's worth. So in 2005, for example, the Bush administration, in an appropriations bill, in one single signing statement, made 116 objections to various provisions of law. That's where the proof is at. The devil in the details, as Ross Perot used to say. So when we count, when we say whether a president has made 100 challenges or 1,000 challenges, what we're doing is we're looking through the document, and in the document the president will say, I challenge the constitutionality, or I find something constitutionally repugnant, and that's how we log them. That's how we count to determine where each president sits as far as their objections may be. Now, if we go from Monroe to Carter, and again, we use Reagan as the jumping off point to where the signing statement changed fundamentally from how it once was used to how it now would be used. We find that all presidents from Monroe to Carter issued a total of 1,510 signing statements. That is, they added 1,510 documents to bills that they had signed into law. Most of those were rhetorical. In fact, the lion's share of all signing statements have been purely rhetorical, where a president congratulates members of Congress or congratulates interest groups. However, where presidents have made constitutional challenges, that number is only 216. So up to that point, presidents didn't rely strategically on the signing statement in quite the same way that presidents from Reagan to where we are now did. And in fact, if you look, 58%, the majority of all constitutional challenges came around that Watergate Vietnam period, where hostility grew towards the executive branch in the Congress and in the public and certainly among the press. And presidents felt that they were under siege and began doing things to defend and protect their constitutional prerogatives. Reagan to Clinton, a total 710 signing statements added to provisions of laws that they had signed. Again, most of those were purely rhetorical. The Clinton administration having the most rhetorical signing statements. 289, though, more than all that had been issued from Monroe to Carter, 289 challenges to various provisions of law, and the Bush 1 administration accounting for the most, a plurality, but nonetheless the most challenges to legislation that impinged upon the powers of the presidency. Now, this administration, by the end of the first term, that is, at the end of 2004, it had challenged more provisions of law than all presidents combined before it. And it is clear that this administration is the outlier as far as the data is concerned. This administration has been more aggressive in protecting the powers of the presidency, and it's been more aggressive in asserting its right as its legislative right to control provisions of law. But as I noted, paradoxically, while they have issued more challenges, they've actually issued fewer signing statements than President Reagan, President Clinton, and his father, President Bush, won. So what does it look like? Total of 149 signing statements up to the end of last year. 31 of these were rhetorical. They clearly don't look at the signing statement as advantageous in the relationship to the public. And the lion's share, 1,143, are challenges that the president makes to provisions of law. They're very aggressive, as I noted, in challenging the various provisions. So the end. Where are we left off then as this president ends its time in office and we prepare for the next president? Well, a couple of things I can say with a degree of certainty. One, The next president of the United States, Democrat or Republican, male or female, will use the signing statement much in the same way as it had been used since the Reagan administration. Perhaps not as much as this administration has. Clearly, one of the downsides to all of the challenges this administration has made is that it has raised the public profile of this particular device. So now there are hearings in Congress, and there's a lot of flack that the president is getting outside of the outside by using these devices. Second, the problem really isn't with the president. The problem lies mostly with Congress. Congress, while it played dumb when this thing hit the newspapers in 2006, it had known presidents were doing this for as long back as I can recall. In the 1980s, members of Congress were rankled over the Reagan administration's interpretation of law or the Reagan administration's challenges. Members who are in the Senate and who were in the Senate Judiciary Committee were familiar with it. It's been the Congress's, mostly the Congress's laying down in the first 6 years of the Bush administration that has created the kind of problem that we're looking at now. Rather than it being an imperial president, as many people suggest, the fact of it is that it's Congress has refused to defend its own institutional powers that have created the greater constitutional crisis, if there is one, than presidents using these particular devices. So I'll end with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
We hope you have enjoyed this Your Connected Audio podcast. If you have suggestions for future podcasts, please let us know by contacting your alumni membership office.